Welcome back to Gulf Coast Live. I'm Julie Glenn. Dr. Bill Mitch knows a thing or two about water, and that's an enormous understatement. Over his 44-year career, he's been a professor specializing in wetland and aquatic biochemistry and ecological engineering at four different universities in the U.S., including the University of Notre Dame, University of Florida, the Ohio State University, and now here at Florida Gulf Coast University. His more than 700 publications include five editions of the textbook Wetlands. So it could be said that he wrote the book. In 2004, he was awarded the Stockholm Water Prize by the King of Sweden, which is essentially the Nobel Prize for Water. These days, he's an eminent scholar and director of the Everglades Wetland Research Park and the Juliet C. Sproul Chair for Southwest Florida Habitat Restoration and Management, and professor of marine and ecological science at FGCU, among other things. We've brought him in on the show today. We're very lucky to get a slice of his time, to get a preview of a lecture that he will be giving tomorrow night at 7 p.m. at the Harvey Kapnick Education and Research Center at the Naples Botanical Garden, called Investigating the Causes and Mitigation of Harmful Algal Blooms, Including Red Tide in South Florida, which, of course, have been hot topics here in Southwest Florida over the past year and, unfortunately, beyond. Dr. Mitch, welcome back to Gulf Coast Live. Thanks so much for your time.
Well, thank you. It's good to be here.
If you'd like to add your voice to our conversation, give us a call now at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media, and on Twitter, we're at WGCU, using the hashtag GCL. You know, last time I saw you, we were on a boat.
Yes, we were.
We were doing some research. Oh, you were doing the research.
Well, no, we were out in the middle of the red tide then. We did two trips that August. Mm-hmm. It was the second week in August, I believe. And it was everywhere off the coast of Southwest Florida then.
And yeah.
It was pretty treacherous to a lot of the people on the boat. They were very affected by it, but I was okay. But we got a lot of samples, very important samples then.
It just kind of felt like a little bit of pepper spray, which is not the most pleasant thing, but it wasn't too bad. So we get a Caloosahatchee conditions report every week from the Sanibel Captiva Conservation Foundation. Mm-hmm. And this week's indicates that there's still cyanobacteria present in Lake Okeechobee and in the river and estuary. And with the red tide blooms still persisting in some patches off the coast, I'm wondering, is this just our new normal now?
It's probably normal that it'll be somewhere. Certainly blue-green algae will be always with us, but it is temperature dependent. So right now we're in the low temperatures in the Gulf of Mexico and in the river and in the lake. So we're not going to have massive blooms, but they'll be back. The red tide is a little tougher to predict. The green blue-green algae, I think it's almost going to happen every year.
Before we start talking too much about present situation here in Southwest Florida, I want to jump back a half a century to the burning of the Cuyahoga River in Ohio.
Right.
What role did that play in how water is regulated in the U.S.?
Well, that's what really got the environmental movement, including the Clean Water Act and a lot of other very important federal legislation started, Environmental Protection Act. That's when the EPA was started. Everything started, and it seemed like that burning river was a symbolic event that just caught everybody's attention. Even though the Cuyahoga River had burned for 20 years, nobody cared about it before. So,
really?
Yes. In fact, Time magazine, when he ran the story that really broke it nationwide, nobody took a picture of the burning in 1969. So they said, well, you got any picture of a burning river? I said, yeah, it burned in 1954, a big fire. I said, give us that one. So they actually ran a picture from like 10 or 15 years earlier of the Cuyahoga burning.
So that got things changed. You got your start in academia not long after that event, and you were in that part of the country, if I'm not mistaken.
Well, that's right when I graduated from undergrad, and that's right when I morphed from being a regular engineer to an environmental engineer and then an ecological engineer, I would say, or ecologist.
And then how did you end up in Southwest Florida at FGCU?
They sought me out. And,
did you just follow the algae?
Well, it wasn't necessarily that. It was because of the Everglades. I had a wonderful career up at Ohio State University, but they had already drained all the wetlands up there. So, you know, I always wanted to finish my career at the big enchilada, which is the Everglades.
It is a big enchilada, but it's kind of a dry enchilada these days, isn't
yes.
it?
Yes. Well, yeah, we go through the dry season and wet season. But that's the trouble. We've exacerbated both. We've made it drier season drier and the wet season wetter. And so the Everglades is really a tipping point for our indication of how well we keep care of our landscape, and I guess we're just not doing a very good job right now.
So when you did come here, were you anticipating ever being here during ground zero of two devastating harmful algal blooms? I mean, this last summer, did you see that coming at all?
Didn't see it coming. But then when the news – I was in Ohio when it was going on because I go to Ohio in the summer, and I started hearing this noise – noise from down here about the red tide. And so I called my lab and said, is anybody out there sampling? And they said, no. And I said, I'm coming down. We're going out in 2 days. So we got out there very quickly. And, of course, I don't know if you remember, but yours was the second boat that, mm-hmm. we were on. The first one was with FCCU and CNN.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the story that broke this wide open to the nation and the world.
Yeah, we'd been covering it. It's just the rest of the world needed to know about it, too, and they started to actually pay attention. It wasn't just the whale shark washing up that got everybody's – that did.
Yeah.
But then these studies really – and the story that they did about it, it was really interesting, and then the stories that we did as well. And I'm wondering, when I was on the boat with you, you were trying to identify a given nitrogen isotope. Mm-hmm. You were trying to put that – you knew you'd find it with the blue-green algae in the river. And I think you were trying to see if that same isotope was present out in the red tide patches.
Yeah. And I don't want to give away my talk. I will talk about it tomorrow.
Oh, okay. Because I remember when I was about ready to give you a call, I heard you were going to be on the show.
No, it's brand new data. We just got a couple of data pieces that fit in 2 days ago.
Really?
Yeah. So we know a lot more than we knew even 3 days ago.
Okay.
So,
spoiler alert.
Yeah, I know. I could tell a story now, but then that would ruin it for everybody.
I know. And apparently it's going to be standing room only. There are people that are really interested in learning the science behind blue-green algae and red tide. They're very invested in it.
Yeah. So
I wouldn't be surprised if you're going to have people flowing out the door.
Oh, the numbers we have are off the chart, but we're gonna accommodate them. We've got some clever ways of videoing it and putting it in different classrooms down there.
Making sure everybody gets to see what's going on. I mean, I know you don't want to do any spoilers here because you do have the event coming up, but what do you think? I mean, you know, from a 30,000-foot point of view, is the root of the problem?
Well, the root of the problem is that we're taking what is a natural phenomenon, red tide, and often described as that as a way of dismissing it, that we can't do anything. But we're accelerating it by very simple, excessive amount of nutrients, especially nitrogen. I've always believed that nitrogen is a problem on coastal waters and phosphorus on the freshwater, and that's got me through my 40 years of professoring. So it's nitrogen, it's excessive nitrogen fertilizer, and it's getting in there and just taking what was sort of a background phenomenon that's there from time to time and just made it a gigantic mess.
Mm-hmm.
So it's naturally caused, human accelerated problem.
I think it'd be interesting to know, because I know we've talked with Mike Parsons on our show, and he's a colleague of yours here at FGCU, about how the nitrogen is getting out there, because it forms, the red tide forms way out off the coast, apparently.
Not necessarily. We saw it, well, you were on the boat with us.
They say that it originates further out, though.
It could, but it's not. When we went out 20 miles off the coast the day before we went on the boat with you,
mm-hmm.
It was. There was no red tide, none, zero at 20 miles.
Hmm.
So it's mostly an intercoastal phenomenon.
Well, it gets pretty bad when it gets here.
Yeah.
But as far as triggering it way out there is I'm wondering about the underground freshwater founts that happen.
Well, that's what they think. But it's definitely marine. Now, that's one thing we did find out, by the way, in that study, I can tell you, that when you go way out and where there's nothing but blue
sand.
Water,
yeah.
That the nitrate was marine origin.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't rainfall. It wasn't pollution. It was just from the marine system.
And it came out of air. And I'm wondering about glycophosphate. Does that play any kind of role?
You mean the pesticide or the herbicide?
Yeah, the weed.
Well,
killers.
There's a theory going on that we're spraying, for example, Lake Okeechobee with the Roundup, and that is in turn causing the algal blooms to be worse. And there's some credence to that, if for no other reason that what they're spraying are emergent plants that shade the water,
mm-hmm.
and you kill that, and then all the sun gets down to the algae very quickly. So that alone would cause the algae to grow better.
Yeah, more the action of the chemical than the chemical itself.
Right.
Right. I'm talking with Dr. Bill Mitch. He's an FGCU eminent professor of marine and ecological science and director of the university's Everglades Wetland Research Park. We're getting a preview of his free lecture, which is tomorrow night at the Harvey Kapnick Education and Research Center at the Naples Botanical Garden, on the causes and mitigation of harmful algal blooms in South Florida. If you'd like to ask him a question or make a comment, give us a call now. The number is 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media, and on Twitter, we're at WGCU using the hashtag GCL. So tell me a little bit about this lecture. I know that there's some new data that you're going to be able to reveal, but what can people expect to hear about? Are you going to walk us through 2016, 17, 18?
And again, it's my view is always from 30,000 feet. I mean, we're going to explain algal blooms in general, how prevalent they are around the world, that this is not the only place where algae is blooming. It's a very serious worldwide phenomenon. And then I'm also going to talk about how we've lost all the wetlands in the world, like 60 to 80% of our wetlands in the world have gone. Mm-hmm. And with that, we're losing the one buffer system that we would need to at least mitigate these algal blooms. So those go hand in hand. So then here we have the Everglades, one of the most beautiful and majestic wetlands in the world. And it's we could send the dirty water down there and it would take it up all right, but then it would not be the Everglades anymore. It would be a big cattail marsh.
Yeah, we did a show yesterday talking about the swamp and the Everglades and,
right.
and the movie, the documentary that's going to be on WGCU next week, I think on Tuesday. And we're going to do another thing at the Conservancy of Southwest Florida with a preview of that documentary talking about the mm-hmm. historic actions that have contributed to the problem with the Everglades. And when we had you on the show last year talking about an idea that you have is to swap out land use from agriculture to wetland and then back again over time, which you're calling kind of wetaculture?
Wetlaculture. So wetlands and then agriculture combined.
How has that – has anybody received that openly?
Oh, I think we're moving along very slowly. Of course, we were originally doing it to win $10 million from the Everglades Foundation for their barley prize.
Oh.
And then we found out we had to be disqualified because we couldn't take our contraption – our contraption was wetlands.
Yeah, we your contraption is acres and acres of wetlands.
We couldn't take our contraption up to Ontario and pour dirty Ontario water in it and see what happens, because all the candidates that have contraptions, you know, sitting on the bench that's the size of this table where I am in the studio, we couldn't do that. I mean, what are we going to do? Put a big flatbed truck with wetlands on the back?
Or try to prove it with a 2-square-foot piece of dirt with a little couple plants in it to see
right,
if that works.
Right, but in very nature, Canada would have different vegetation in Florida.
Yeah.
So we couldn't take it up there. And I argued and argued, and they said, no, Bill, we can't do it. So we had to withdraw. But that's what started it,
mm-hmm.
the idea. And so we kept up with it because we think we got something very novel.
It is.
We call it flipping. We don't say rotating crop. That demeans the whole process.
Yeah, because I'm sitting here thinking crop rotation.
No.
You go from soybean to corn, I mean, being a Midwesterner.
No, this is – right. This is a little more significant, because this is one way to get half of our landscape into wetlands and half in agriculture and be flipping. I use that term deliberately because young people understand that.
Yeah.
And flipping landscapes between wetlands and agriculture, where the wetland is the system that takes the phosphorus out of the water and into the soil, and then the agriculture is the system that takes the fertilizer out of the soil and into society.
Mm-hmm.
And when you do that, you're basically recycling all the mess that we have in cycle, and we stop fertilizing. You actually can stop fertilizing if this works according to our plan.
Yeah.
At least for 50 years until we clean up the mess.
So you get a given amount of acres of agricultural land. You turn that into wetland. How mm-hmm. long does it need to stay wetland and get flipped back to ag?
Well, those are the two variables.
Okay.
How long does it stay wetland and how long does it then stay agriculture? That we're running experiments now on a small scale where we're using just giant buckets, 100-gallon tubs that are sometimes used to give water to horses, as I understand. Rubbermaid makes them.
Mm-hmm.
And we've got 28 of these tubs set up at three different locations. Two are set up in Ohio and one set up in Freedom Park right here in Naples.
Mm-hmm. We have a couple calls on the line, and I'm not surprised. People are so interested in this subject. First, we're going to take a call from Eric in Northport, who has a question. Eric, what would you like to ask?
Yeah, I have a question. Just wondering what his opinion is. When they had the oil spill, the killing off of a lot of the shrimp and the crabs that eat a lot of the detritus material on the bottom of the ocean, I was curious as to whether he thought that had an impact on the increase in the red tide blooms as a result of tertiarily.
That's a really good question. There was an article that got that made a lot of waves talking about.
Yeah. Well, there's been a lot of trying to relate the oil spill to these recent red tide blooms. I don't think there's an obvious link there. The Gulf of Mexico is vast. I mean, you don't know that until you get out on it, but it's a vast body of water. And even as bad as that oil spill was, there's a lot of clean water still out there. And I think how do you prove this? I mean, in other words, how do you do experiment? Well, you need two Gulfs of Mexico, and you have pollute one and leave the other unpolluted. We don't have the capability of doing that. And small scales sometimes don't go up to big scale. So it's an interesting idea. How you'd ever prove that, though, would be very, very difficult for modern science even.
It's been interesting this week talking with scientists. It's all kind of coming back up, the pressure on scientists to what is going on. I mean, it seems like it's a very critical thing when you see tons and tons of marine life washing up on beaches and people are looking to scientists for answers. But scientists aren't going to say this is the thing until they have the data to back it up. And that's the thing I keep repeating.
And there's another aspect to that. Scientists, as a rule, and I'm a split person. I'm a scientist some days and I'm an engineer another. Scientists describe problems, and really the process of engineering is what solves problems. Now, the engineers out there will be saying, yay, Bill. But but it's true. So what we have done is a lot of explaining. When you interview people here, they're explaining. They're telling you how loud it is. They're telling you we're monitoring it. But you very rarely hear solutions. We're different. We do ecological engineering, and we know that there's an ecological solution to almost every ecological problem. I mean, ecological engineers can't build airplanes, and and we don't want them to. But they
even if the problem's man-made?
But I'm saying if the problem man-made, if there's an ecological solution, and here there has to be, there is no possibility of doing a mechanical wastewater treatment type of solution to the massive amount of nutrients we have in our landscape.
Yeah, we've seen the people with like you were talking about, people with a test project that can fit on a folding table.
Right. You can't extrapolate that up to the Everglades scale. It's impossible. So we need to call on Mother Nature. And guess what? Just when we need her, Mother Nature has this ecosystem called wetlands that we need.
Mm-hmm.
And especially down here. And that's why in my talk I say at the end, the answer is right in front of us and we don't even think about it.
Exactly. I'm going to get to another caller. This is Jim in Naples Park. Jim, what would you like to ask?
So the professor spoke about how humans are contributing to these harmful algae blooms with the nutrients and fertilizer. What about how humans with climate change are making the Gulf warmer? So can we look forward to more of these harmful algae blooms, red tide, in the future because of the warmer Gulf?
Yes, Jim, absolutely. In fact, our new norm, and I'm glad you brought that up. I would have eventually. It's not only the fact that we've saturated our landscape with nutrients. That's number one. But just as equally important is we're doing it into a warmer planet. So the Gulf of Mexico is warmer, and that causes two things. That causes the red tide. On average, algal blooms will be more fierce just because of the temperature. And secondly, it creates a sort of a hotter nurturing bed for hurricanes. So the new norm, if I can say this, is more red tides and more hurricanes cleaning them up. Because the hurricane does stir up the water and get rid of red tide. We've had experiences on that now. But that's the new norm. And it's going to get worse every year as long as we continue to heat the planet.
Well, Jim, there's your answer. Thank you for calling, Jim.
Okay.
We also have a call coming in from Paul in Punta Gorda. Paul has a follow-up to the question of the oil spill. Paul, what would you like to ask?
Yeah, Professor, I heard you answer his question. What about phosphates and the phosphate industry? You know, the river north of the Caloosahatchee, the Peace River, the Manatee, the Hillsborough, they've been basically a drain field for the phosphate industry for 130 years now.
Yeah.
And I lived through the 67 and 71 spills as a kid, and I recently done research, and in 1973, there's a great article, it was in the Herald Tribune, about an old-timer who was a Venice commissioner that claims that in the 30s, fishermen used to always say anytime phosphate was released, and there's been 30 spills in the Peace River alone since 1935, that the old-timers would predict a worse-than-normal red tide. And he even claims that red tides did start further offshore, and there was an eddy that eddied out of Charlotte Harbor, and he predicted one after the 71 spill, and sure enough, it was a really bad red tide. And I don't see anybody doing research on this.
But oh, my goodness.
I
spent half my career doing phosphorus. And by the way, phosphorus is the element. Phosphate is the inorganic form that usually causes the algae blooms, and I prefer to just refer to phosphorus in general. But you're absolutely right. That's the most important limiting factor for algal growth in freshwater systems normally. And that's because there are many algae that can fix nitrogen out of the freshwater algae that can fix nitrogen. And so therefore, the freshwater algal blooms that we were seeing all along the Caloosahatchee before it became saltwater, those are due to probably phosphorus. Now, can phosphorus also be a cause, an accelerator for red tide? Of course. Nitrogen and phosphorus are just the two culprits that we have to deal with.
And people are studying that, right?
Yeah, we don't have to deal with a whole 120-some elements on the periodic table. There's two that we have to focus on. And all I was saying is the generality is that phosphorus is usually a problem in freshwater, and nitrogen is usually a problem in coastal water, but they do intermix all the time, of course.
Yeah.
And then one other thing I have to tell you, I was thought you were going to say after the spills in the 1930s that they claimed that fishing was better, because it used to be a common agricultural process in farm ponds to dump nutrients, phosphorus, in your lake to increase fisheries. That was a standard procedure.
Really?
And it's still the standard procedure in some parts of this country.
For freshwater lakes, right?
For freshwater lakes, to dump a little phosphorus in, and then the bluegills and the bass are that much better.
But the impacts of phosphate mining is being studied.
Yeah.
Right?
But he's talking about spills that are massive
spills,
quantities.
Yeah.
And that's a whole other story.
Yeah. Well, that is all the time that we have for today's show, but I want to thank my guest, Dr. Bill Mitch, FGCU Eminent Professor of Marine and Ecological Science and Director of the University's Everglades Wetland Research Park. I love getting to spend time talking with you.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for coming.
Well, I enjoyed it, and everybody should show up for the talk tomorrow, and I'll give us the data that we were collecting on the boat.
It's a cliffhanger. I just can't. I'm going to beg you to tell me when we get off here. This is going to be at the Harvey Kapnick Education and Research Center at the Naples Botanical Garden. And again, that is tomorrow night. Our show today was produced by Mike Canary and myself. Our director is Richard Chin Kui. Our social media coordinator is Tara Callaghan. Gulf Coast Live is made possible through the generous support of the Elizabeth B. McGraw Foundation. For now, thanks for listening. I'm Julie Glenn. This is WGCU-FM, Fort Myers, 90.1. WMKO, Marco Island, 91.7 FM. NPR for Southwest Florida.